Good day and welcome to another episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, and we are excited to be back here as always. And we've got a topic tonight we're going to be touching on that comes from one of you, the listeners, who reached out to us, sent us a great email about something they wanted to see on the show and hear us chat about. So we're going to be reaching out with that. A little more on that later, but before I get to that, I have to, of course, introduce my co-host, Sam. Welcome back. I understand you were at a writer's conference recently. I know you write quite a bit, and it's good to have you back, but I'm sure you've got your writing mojo going right now.
Yeah, I truly feel like Disaster Sam at the moment because you know what it's like after a conference. You go to a conference for 5 or 6 days, and it takes you 2 weeks trying to get back to normal. So that's kind of what I've been doing all day today. But I'm here, and I'm glad to be talking about this subject and glad to say hi to Dr. Joe Holly. Hi, Joe.
Hi, guys. Good to have you back.
Thank you. Good to see you, sort of. Not really see you, you know, but talk to you.
That's all right. We're all, you know, that's the beautiful thing about this show is that, you know, Sam, you're on the West Coast in California. Joe, you're down in Memphis, and I'm up here in Maryland, and we kind of cover a big portion of the country with where we are located, and that gives us our own unique perspectives on things. But it's great to have you back on the show, Joe, and hopefully we'll be able to get. I know you did some research on this topic when we heard about it, and I'm looking forward to hearing your input.
Well, sounds great. It's a topic near and dear to my heart as well, and has a lot of common ground with disaster medicine in general.
The topic we're talking about, since we've been beating around the bush quite a bit here, is we're actually talking about wilderness medicine and how that relates to disaster medicine. It's a lot of people out there that have maybe gone through some classes for wilderness preparedness or wilderness EMT classes to get certified. And we got an email from listener Tim who wanted to have us touch on that. And he actually gave us a contact that we're still trying to reach out to, either that person or somebody else that we have contact with, to bring on an expert in wilderness EMS on the show and have them talk with us about what they see as some of the differences and things. But in the meantime, we thought we'd just touch on it ourselves based on our own knowledge and our own expertise in the past. And you know, there are some very, I think, good similarities between the austere nature of medicine in a wilderness setting and what might be encountered in an overwhelmed area during a disaster response. And Joe, that seems to be what your research turned up.
Well, I agree with you completely. You know, I think the operative word there is austere, and with that comes the word improvisation, which is very much what both wilderness and disaster medicine are full of, making the best out of what you got. So it's just another side of the coin for the supply and demand concept of you have lots of demands on what you need and a limited supply of stuff you can use to take care of the problem. So that the two go arm in arm, I think, in a lot of ways. It just depends on a little bit of the scope and scale of the incident itself.
And I have to be reminded of my 15 years with National Ski Patrol. And at the end of the day, no doubt there would be somebody lost wandering around in the snow, very ill prepared to spend the night in the mountains. And so I think that's something I would like to touch on with you too, Joe. It's just, you know, using common sense, basic. I mean, there's mountaineers and hikers and people that do this regularly and know how to prepare themselves. And then there's people that may go out for a weekend hike with the family and not really be prepared. And I want to touch on that because I hate to hear those stories of them turning up in the spring because nobody was able to locate them and they weren't able to survive the night.
That's a big...
Well, I think you're exactly right, Sam. Some of that's weekend warrior syndrome with folks getting a little bit over their head, but even experienced outdoorsmen can get themselves in trouble. And I think knowledge and preparation are the key there to keeping you safe.
Yeah, I did an episode of the Medic Cast, it's probably been 4 or 5 years ago, with some of the folks at Wilderness Medical Associates, who are one of the primary training providers for Wilderness EMS training. And, one of the things they talked about was that it was a different mindset. It wasn't typical EMS. And that's one of the things that drove me to thinking how this would really connect well with what we talk about in disaster EMS and disaster medicine, because they kind of drew the juxtaposition between the two sides of EMS. EMS in the city and our typical 911 services, you know, we have a patient for an hour, maybe 2 hours. We drop them off at the ER, they're done. We've finished our care and are back in the field to take another call. Whereas in the wilderness EMS setting, that patient could be with you for days. And it's similar to what we've been talking about all along here on the show, that disaster medicine is the same type of thing, where you have to treat and manage a patient for a longer term. And if you're looking straight at the EMS responders out there, that's something very different from what they expect to do. Now, Joe, you know, as an ER doc and a physician, you're much more prepared to care for a patient in a longer term setting. And so your team is as well, but it is something to point to is different from your typical ER patient even.
Well, you're exactly right, Jamie, and as is typical with disaster medicine as well, you know, the element of time is very prominent in wilderness medicine. You may well be very distant from significant medical care. You've got to transport a patient in challenging circumstances. The patient may well be yourself, but it's that issue related to the impact of time on what in many cases might otherwise be relatively minor conditions or problems that worsen over time because we don't have the resources on hand to treat them at the time.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm thinking, I've just been going through my mind on little scenarios that I remember, and I haven't talked too much about having been on National Ski Patrol, but of course that's a winter environment. And that's an even worse case for people getting lost. And even the simple act of breaking a leg, which wouldn't incapacitate somebody, I mean, it isn't necessarily a serious injury, but if that person, it eliminates that person's ability to get up out of the snow and go find help. And when you're sitting in the snow, that snow is pulling that heat right out of your core in a hurry. And I think one of the things, would you agree, Joe, that people face out in these austere environments when they're not prepared is hypothermia, which is a much more dangerous to them than a broken leg or anything else.
Oh, I think you're exactly right, Sam. You know, it tends to be relatively insidious in its onset. People don't really appreciate how cold they're getting and how quickly they are getting cold. We certainly see that in disaster environment where people are wet and in contact with the ground or concrete, which of course is notorious for pulling heat away from you aggressively, but probably not quite to the extreme that snow would. But the processes are still the same, where you're dropping your body core temperature down, and that affects not only your mentation, but everything from your blood chemistries to your clotting factors, and the more direct effects of things like frostbite and vasoconstriction and other things that we think more typically with cold exposure.
Well, I got to ask you guys something. And Jamie, you've had nursing training, so you learned this from a different perspective than we have. And of course, Joe's a physician. But one thing I have always heard is that at some point in the hypothermia spectrum, people become apathetic about their own survival. And I've seen this indicated on the plane crash movie where the hero is leading all the people out and then suddenly he sits in the snow and goes, okay, I'm just going to die now. What can you tell me about that, Joe? Is there some truth to that? Because I don't know that I've ever witnessed it, but I've certainly heard about it.
Well, I think it is a recognized phenomenon. I don't think that it probably happens every time, but I think as you become more and more hypothermic, you lose your ability to have sound judgment. And it's not uncommon to see folks beginning to strip off their clothing, even though they're very, very cold, because they simply can't think straight. I think at some point you probably do reach a point where, you know, I don't know if it's delusional or just complete and utter exhaustion, or simply that your brain can't function very well anymore due to the extremes of temperature, and you simply stop and give up, or you think you're someplace where you're not, or you think you're in a situation that's safe and you're actually not. So I think your judgment gets very poor there, and you continue to put yourself in harm's way in multiple different ways, which of course just leads to a bad outcome.
And I know one of the other key things is your inability to use fine motor skills. And again, you see that in the movie where the guy's got two dry pieces of wood and one match, and he can't strike the one match because he can't get his fingers to work. So that in reality is, I mean, that's an extreme situation, but that could happen. Once you get to the point where you can't use your fine motor skills, there's a lot you're not going to be able to do.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think that's part of the problem with it, is people don't appreciate how quickly those things come on you. And again, they're not as obvious and as blatant to see as you might think they are. You know, you simply feel cold for a while and you shiver for a while and you try to warm yourself up. But as you kind of pass through that phase, you begin to lose that judgment and that awareness and that sensory input that you need, and you don't understand that your fine motor skills are going bad, and therefore you use your last match and you can't get the fire started, and then you're simply stuck.
Well, I know in my experience on a number of levels, one of the best things I think I carry around, and I think you would agree with this too, is the simple space blanket. It is very small. You can put it even in your pocket, but this is something that can actually save a life.
Oh, no question about it. You know, I think there's a lot of really, really interesting little things that people can take along with them to address stuff like that. You know, and if you look at the common things that occur in the wilderness, most of them are not complex. It's things like basic environmental issues, from weather-related problems to clean water to you know, wound care should you injure yourself in some sort of way, to you know, having to take care of an envenomation by an animal or something like that. So, you know, it's not an awful lot of unusual problems.
You know, a question occurred to me as I was listening to you guys talk about just the hypothermia issue, and it is something that would occur to me in a wilderness setting or in a disaster setting. At what point do you have to draw the line between these are my personal resources and requirements, and these are the things I need to protect for my own survival and ability to continue to do my job as a responder, either in the wilderness setting or in a disaster setting, and what can be shared with the people around you who need care? You know, and I wondered, Joe, is that something that has cropped up in your travels and responses for you or Sam, where you've felt like you had resources that you had to protect for your team, because they had to continue to do their job and needed these resources that couldn't be given out, even though there was a need in the community for the population to have some additional food or shelter or whatever the case may be.
Go ahead, Sam.
No, I was just going to say, I look at it from the perspective that if your responders aren't healthy and able to function, they can't help anybody. So, you know, that, of course, we always look at our team members as a priority, but that's a basic fact. If you take out that element, if the responder, you know, gives his water or his supplies to somebody else, he is eliminating his ability to help everybody, and he has skills that nobody else has. So I think looking at it from that perspective, it's not a selfish motive. It's his ability to do his job.
And I'd have to agree with you. Obviously, it's that same caveat in disaster medicine where you have to take care of yourself and you have to be safe. Otherwise, you simply turn yourself into another victim, and then you consume health care and rescue resources as opposed to provide them. So I think watching out for yourself is absolutely vitally important to be able to take care of anybody else. We've had a few of those instances where resources were really thin. I think we're, especially domestically, you know, unless you're way out in the wilderness, and certainly from a disaster standpoint, there are enough resources flowing into the area that my team and myself have always felt pretty comfortable just erring on the side of the patient and giving the patient whatever it was they needed, knowing that we can reach back and get that resupplied at some point. I wouldn't want to leave the team barren, of course, of resources, but we have enough there that we can at least get the job done. So certainly things like food and water and that sort of stuff, we don't hesitate much with that. We're happy to pass that stuff on. And medical resources we're pretty deep in as well, so we can afford to leave a clinic or a hospital or whatever, some small number of supplies that we have available to help them at least get through this up for the short term.
Yeah, that's always good. Well, let me put you on the spot, Joe, and I'll throw this out to Jamie too, because he might have a different idea on it. But if you were out running around the mountains, so you didn't have a backpack, or you did, but there was nothing in it, and you could take three pieces of equipment outside of food and water, what would those three things be?
Well, that's an interesting thing. I think I would take tape of some sort, probably duct tape. I think having something like a safety pin is incredibly valuable. Just, you know, it can do everything from, you know, drain a blister to get a splinter out to, you know, hold a sling together. That kind of stuff. And here's a strange one, but a tool that I have found phenomenally valuable and amazingly, flexible in its ability, and that is the Foley catheter. I know it's a really strange
thing. I did not see that coming.
I didn't either. You got me there.
And do a lot of stuff, apart from being a Foley catheter. I mean, you can use it to control severe posterior nosebleeds. You can make a stethoscope out of it. You can make a tourniquet out of it. You can make a chest tube out of it. You can, siphon water. You can make a slingshot out of it. You can make all kinds of stuff out of Foley catheters. And, you know, they're a pretty doggone valuable tool.
Oh, my God. Jamie, you got to set up the show notes to say, okay, you have to guess which piece of equipment you'd never in your world, in the world, come up with off the top of your head.
We're gonna make people listen to this one all the way through to hear what Joe would bring.
Well, the world would be devoid of Foley catheters here suddenly.
Okay. Yeah, no kidding. But they truly do have all kinds of uses. You know, I mean, being able to stop a pretty severe posterior nosebleed with a catheter works pretty well, surprisingly enough.
Who would have thought? What do you think, Jamie? What else would you add to that?
Well, I would have included some kind of multi-tool or something with a blade on it and maybe some other assorted tools. I'm partial to the Leatherman, but the Gerber or any of those types of tools out there.
And I think you're exactly right, Jamie. I mean, you've got to have a tool like that of some sort. You know, I carry a pocket knife with me all the time that's got a lot of that stuff on it, so I don't really think about packing that one as a separate tool, but that one is absolutely indispensable.
Yeah, but I like the duct tape or some kind of tape like that. It just it's useful for so many things, so a roll of duct tape goes with me everywhere I go. Pretty much, it's in the back of the car all the time. And then I'm always have my Leatherman with me. I always feel naked when I'm going on a flight somewhere because I've got to put it in my checked baggage. So I at least have it when I get to where I'm going. But it's one of those things I always think about what would happen if, I would need something else or need that extra thing. And that's important. You know, we were talking about what we bring with us in a situation and resources that people can find and how people are unprepared. And I just while we were talking about it, I went to the National Park Service site, which is nps.gov. You can look up any of the national parks out there, and every national park has a set of resources for that park on what you need for a day trip, what you need for, I'm looking at the Yellowstone page now, and there's a backcountry camping and hiking section, and there's an online backcountry trip planner.
Oh, that's great.
That you can download the PDF.
No, that's cool.
And it just lets you check off all the things that you need for a given trip so that you don't forget. And this is from the experts. This is from the park rangers themselves. If they know what people have forgotten and needed based on their experience having to go and bail people out. So just wanted to put it out there that people get themselves in trouble and responders can get themselves in trouble, but with a little bit of planning, and it took me all of 2 minutes to pull up this information, with a little bit of planning and forethought, you could be much better prepared, and it wouldn't necessarily be an onerous load to carry around with you if you were going on a given location and wanted to be prepared with the things you need. And you'd still have room, I guess, in that pack for that Foley catheter.
That doesn't take up much room. Well, it's funny because Joe's kind of thinking in terms of how he could provide medical care in that environment. I was thinking more about, personal care, but I think a couple of things that I would throw into our pack. One would be a whistle. And as much as I thought, because that's one of the federal requirements, and I'm thinking, well, what do we need a whistle for? Because we're always with 50 other people, 49 other people. But you could get separated or lost and say you can't move. You have a broken leg. That way, at least you can alert to somebody where you are, and it doesn't take any space. And the other thing, like Joe's Foley catheter, I love simple cravats. And those are another tool that you can fold up pretty quickly, to a small size and carry a number of them. And you can use them for everything from a sling and a swath to basically any kind of bandage, basically. You could even use them for a shawl, I suppose, or stopping a nosebleed. I mean, you could create a splint out of them. I mean, they're another one of those things like Joe's Foley that are just very amenable to all kinds of different things.
That's another place you could use the space blanket to... On the spine. So.
Well, and to Joe, you're talking about when you said tape, it kind of hit me. That isn't the first thing I thought of, but you could take space blanket and some of your tape and create a little pup tent if you needed to, because shelter is another thing that most people wouldn't know how to create for themselves, but it can be critically important.
Absolutely.
Or use the Foley catheter and use it to collect rainwater. Any number of things we could do.
That could take a while.
I'm not getting into that, am I?
Sorry, Joe, but this is going to be the Foley catheter episode forever and beyond.
Well, okay, maybe some listeners out there will come up with some of their own ideas, and they'll have
that
something.
Would be awesome. Just I would love for Tim or anybody out there to come up with some things that are truly unusual like that we wouldn't probably think to put in a backpack or a disaster kit. I think that's awesome. I love it.
But Joe, it points out that some of the things you were talking about before we were starting recording the show and kind of banging some ideas around of what we were going to talk about in this episode. And you talked about improvisational medicine, which is that using the tools that you have available to achieve a treatment result with a patient. And you pointed out that the safety pin could be used for multiple purposes, and the Foley catheter could be used for multiple purposes, not just for its intended purpose, but for many other medically related purposes. And I just have to wonder, when you talk about, clearly this is something you've thought about or used in the past in your travels in disaster medicine, and yet you're pointing out that the uses for it in a wilderness setting or any kind of austere medical environment where you have to make do with what you have.
Well, you're exactly right, Jamie. You know, it very much is repurposing a tool for something other than its original intent. I think it's part of what makes disaster medicine and wilderness medicine, austere medicine of any sort, a lot of fun and a lot of much more of a challenge. And part of the reason I'm so passionate about it is because it does challenge you to think outside the box a little bit and not practice medicine like you might do in your everyday job. So.
Yeah, so those of us that do this kind of strange thing in terms of austere environment, you know, we have to think on both levels. We have to think in terms of personal preparedness as well as those kinds of things that, like, God, I love the Foley, that are really multi-purpose and can treat a patient or treat someone else you're out there in the wilderness with if you have a need to. And that kind of reminds me, and we touched on it a number of times in our many discussions we've had now, but I just want to touch on the whole idea of just wherever you are, whatever kind of disasters may befall you, you need to have disaster kits. And Jamie has already illustrated. I mean, we talked specifically about mountaineering and you know, backpacking, but you need to have a kit in your home. And I think something we may not have talked as much about is you need something in your car. What if you're stuck out here in the San Francisco Bay Area? God knows we could be stuck, and it'd scare the hell out of me, but we could be stuck on a bridge somewhere and not be able to go anywhere. What do you have in your car that's going to help you, you know, food, water, again, some of the things we talked about, your knife, your duct tape, and of course, you're not going to do a whole lot in the middle of the bridge, but say you're somewhere else where the roads are impassable, you just can't get anywhere. So having a kit in your car is always a great idea, as well as certainly something at home. You know, we could do a number of podcasts just on what those contents would be, but just like Jamie said with Yellowstone, ready.gov is a great resource. It's a federal government resource, clearly, that has it, and it even breaks it down into, you know, hurricanes, earthquakes, things that are kind of specific to different disasters beyond just what you may need as a family with your pets and babies and older people and all of that. So I thought it was a good time to throw that out there and remind people.
Well, and right on the front, right there in the center of the page at ready.gov is build a kit. And there are all the information there you need for a basic kit of what you need, water, food, how much, then all the other assorted things you need, including, Sam, a whistle to signal for help, which I thought was interesting. And then also how to maintain your kit. So once you've built a kit, how often do you need to trade things out of your kit? Where should you store it? What should you do with food in your kit? And then car safety is included there. So you can build a kit for your car. So you have a kit in your home and a kit for when you're traveling. It's just very interesting. And again, these resources are out there. And if you're a responder or listening to this program, these are things you can link to off of your company's website, your organization's website, to help prepare your communities. Because as we've talked about here on the show in the past, you know, Joe and Sam have said is that it takes 72 hours to get boots on the ground. And those first 72 hours, people are going to be on their own and really have to be self-sufficient to a large extent. And that means your community, you and your families, as well as your disaster responders. And so make a link to these resources on your organization's webpage. Have a list of what the common kit would be needed for your region based on its climate and resources. All of these things are important. And it needs to be stressed that, again, it takes time to get the disaster planning resources from the federal and state level out to where the site of the disaster is. And even if the, if Joe and Sam are ready to jump at a moment's notice, doesn't mean that they can get there even overnight. It's going to take several days.
Well, and I'm noticing a couple things on this list, Jamie. I pulled some things off the ready.gov. Can opener. Now, you may not think about that, but if all your stored food is in cans, that would be a real bummer if you couldn't open any of them. Whistle, certainly. Dusk mask. You know, Joe, in talking about USAR, you're certainly in an environment where you're sucking up a lot of dust and you don't want to breathe that in. It talks about hand crank radio, so you don't have to depend on batteries for them. I actually, for DMAT, I carry a solar charger. So, because I know we're always, you know, don't have a lot of outlets for everybody to charge things. So I have one that actually charges if you sit it in the sun long enough. But Joe, I got to ask you, too, you know, getting back to my whistle, which is my point here. When you're doing search and rescue, and we talked about the numerous occasions after an earthquake or a tornado where you're trying to dig people out. If you, and I remember one of the videos that you showed us at the conference where somebody, where you're going literally through the floor to try and get into somebody's bedroom, and you can't really see that much of where they could possibly be. If that person had a whistle, I would think that would certainly cut the time down on which direction you're going to dig in to try and get to them, wouldn't you say?
Oh, I think there's no question about that, Sam. You know, we use sound a lot as a methodology to locate people, whether that's tapping on a pipe or clicking two things together in the space that they're in. Those sounds travel pretty well through solid objects and allow us to localize objects in a lot of different ways. So any sort of noise-making device, especially something as shrill as a whistle, is a great choice to signal folks where you are and that you're still functional enough to blow a whistle to alert folks that you need help.
Yeah, and that way you're going to dig a little faster. I know with out here in earthquake country, one thing they always tell us, and I actually taught earthquake preparedness for Red Cross for many years, and it's something you don't think about, have a heavy pair of shoes under your bed. Because what happens is people, the most common injury in that scenario is people jump out of bed, they run into the living room, they want to see what damage there was, or they're just afraid and they're trying to run out the door, and they end up cutting their feet on broken glass and any number of other things. So people aren't thinking about that, but if you have that pair of shoes right under your bed, you don't have to go search for in your closet for them. You can just throw them on, and that right there might save you a lot of injury.
Oh, I think that's a great idea. You know, certainly if you cut your feet up trying to just, you know, get across the room, then if that wasn't the big shock comes a few minutes later, mm-hmm. You know, the structure actually does start coming down. You're really going to want those shoes on to try to get yourself out of there. So I think shoes are vitally important there.
Yeah, and again, it's just one of those things we don't often think about. What about your end of town, Jamie? What are some of the things you key on for preparing?
For us, it's really, you know, we're in a community without public water. Most everybody around here has wells and septic systems. So for us, it's and for my primary preparedness kit for my family, one of the things we keep is a bunch of gallon jugs of milk. Milk jugs full of water, basically. We don't use them for drinking water. I have a couple cases of drinking water and the bottles always on hand for drinking water, but just to flush the toilet.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
or bathe or
whatever we need to do. The water is clean. I clean out the containers with bleach water first, and then I pour in the water and add a little bit of bleach, and I keep them in the basement for, you know, a year, and then I bring them up every year, refill them, put them back down there. So I have about 10 gallons of water. Based upon the fact that we can lose power for a couple of days, I know we can flush the toilets in our house. And we have water, bottled water. We have our food supplies. We can stay here in place and shelter in place for a couple of days safely. And without too much loss of sanitation and the ability to do what we need to do.
And they also say in some situations you can fill up your bathtub.
Yep.
Now you're in a different scenario with a well. Maybe you can't do that, but for those that aren't dependent on electricity, I guess, to get water, at least to the extent that you can drain your hot water heater into your bathtub, at least you might have that
that water available.
Yep.
What about tornadoes and that kind of thing, Joe?
Oh, it certainly applies around here just like it does any place else. Tornadoes can basically have the same effect as an earthquake as far as leveling the building and causing pretty extreme damage. Obviously not quite on the vast scale that an earthquake might, but
I don't know. I've seen some.
Anyway, there have been some pretty bad ones recently for sure, so no doubt about it.
I'm curious, Joe, when you guys do your training with Paragon and you pull your teams together and your classes, do you address personal preparedness at all? What people might need to have with them for a given response?
We do sort of peripherally, I think. Our approach really is a lot more about, having folks come in fairly comfortable clothes that they might be going to work in, and then with, enough personal protective equipment to keep them safe during the exercise, allowing them to see what it's like to work in those kind of clothes that they're in. And, that's just everything from boots to tennis shoes. And people, I think, see pretty quickly the advantages or the pros and cons of different kinds of footwear and not having, heavy gloves or, boy, I sure wish I had a, fill in the blank at the end of the day. So
catheter.
Well, yeah, I haven't heard that one, I'll have to say. I haven't heard anybody say they want to pull a catheter. But I think having been through that once, you leave that experience with that kind of stuff much more meaningful to you as far as somebody just talking about it or going, oh yeah, I wish I'd had a pair of X kind of shoes. Having been there and spent all day in rubble and that kind of stuff, you certainly fairly quickly learn to appreciate the advantages of the right kind of equipment.
Yeah, I had your toes crushed a couple of times.
Well, Joe, we could talk about this as usual. We get into these topics and we find ourselves chatting about it, on and on, because there's just so many great things we could be discussing. And we're going to revisit wilderness medicine in a future episode with a wilderness medicine expert on the show. But, we want to thank, first of all, Tim for giving us the idea for this episode and sending us an email. Please continue to reach out to us. You can do that in lots of different ways, but we love to hear from you, and we responded back. I think several of us responded back to Tim just to let him know we appreciated the email and that we were considering his topic for a future episode. Joe, where can folks find you and Paragon and what you guys are doing if they want to get some of this experiential learning about how disaster response and preparedness works?
Well, Paragon is on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com or on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group. And our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU. And to Tim, I hope he'll email us again and let us know what his three most common and needed tools are. He's in the wilderness.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, tweet it out there and see what your favorite three things you'd need to have for disaster preparedness and hashtag it disaster podcast, and we'll find it.
I love that. Let's see how many responses we can get. It might be interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, in the usual social media places, SamBradley11 on Twitter, Sam Bradley on Facebook, and most certainly on the disasterpodcast.com.
And you can find me, as always, under the handle PodMedic in most places. So if you're looking for me on Facebook or Twitter or any of those places, look me up under PodMedic. And, of course, leave a comment over at disasterpodcast.com. In any of the episodes there's a link for comments right below the episode. And let us know what you think of what our topics are. Let us know your three items you'd carry with you if you had to choose what you would take into an austere environment if you could only pick three things. I'd love to know if anybody else came up with a Foley catheter for their
they will
tool
now.
Of choice. Sam, you want to wrap us up?
Well, I think we've clearly shown that whether it's austere medicine or disaster medicine, it's not your everyday medicine.